She hesitated at the bottom of the stairs that led to the second floor. I'm not sure about this. Jesse's internal reaction was an irritated, I wish you told us that before we got here. But that is not what he said. Okay, why? If the squids know those guys, she pointed upward, are dead. Their first thought won't be that a sniper is in this area. They're going to think the Legion is occupying this place. Ah, shit. He realized she was right. What's plan B?
Wait, please.
Nert held up a hand.
If you were here, and you killed enemy soldiers who found you, what would you do?
Jesse had to laugh. Nert was a cadet, and he had more sense than two seasoned staff sergeants. We would get the hell out of here pronto. The squids won't expect us to stay in a location that's been compromised.
Huh.
Shauna agreed. Good point. The squids will be paying attention to this place, though. I don't like how exposed we are. Nert pointed to the center of the structure.
That elevator shaft is empty. We could climb up inside it, and no one would see us.
Jesse looked to Shauna. What do you think?
I think,
she tugged tight the sling holding the sniper rifle,
maybe Nert should be team leader.
They crawled out of the elevator shaft on the top floor, Jesse going first and helping the others navigate the awkward transition. Shauna looked around.
This is good.
The roof above them had a big hole in the center where equipment and supplies had been lowered by crane. The top floor was especially cluttered, with stacks of supplies arranged toward the outside of the surface.
Be careful,
she pointed to a gap in the concrete-like floor panel. The floor was honeycombed with holes and trenches where cables were being installed. Leaning over one wide trench, she whistled.
It is a long way down if we fall.
Nert walked over to a stack of panels.
I can lay these over the holes near the elevator shaft. If we have to get out of here, we will need to move quickly.
Good idea. Shauna smiled at the cadet with affection. See, Jesse? Nert should be team lead.
Oh, no thank you.
Nert shook his head.
That is above my pay grade.
Pay? Jesse laughed. It was always funny when aliens used human expressions. Nert, I will cover the holes. You check on our drone. See if we have any unfriendly company around here. In each direction from the top floor, there was good cover. Without a target to shoot at, Shauna set up near the elevator shaft where she was less likely to be seen by an enemy drone. Their own drone had detected a rival enemy device zipping past them from the east. All three of them froze as the Wargalan drone flew past, unseen. It disappeared behind the water tower, moving at high speed and not slowing down. Whatever the drone was searching for, it was not in their area of the city. The drone was a reminder that even if they could not see the enemy might see them. Jesse looked at Shauna cradling her new sniper rifle, wondering if he had a romantic rival. She sure seemed to love the thing.
Hey, darling, he whispered.
What? She was concentrating on the view through the rifle scope from the drone, getting the rifle's brain to build up a picture of the surrounding area.
The army taught us that indirect fire can be more important than direct fire, right?
Yeah, so?
I'm wondering. That toy you have can shoot sideways, around corners, drop ordnance straight down on the enemy's heads, you know? Maybe this type of sniper rifle is indirect fire.
Show me a target in my line of sight, she whispered back with grim determination, and I'll show you what direct fire looks like. Nert, Jesse called. Can you move the drone south about 2 blocks? I want to see.
We must be very careful about moving the drone,
Nert warned.
It is almost invisible when hovering, but motion sensors might detect it. We have been lucky so far. I am surprised the drone has lasted this long.
Right. Got it. Jesse wanted to snap that he was aware of the recommended techniques for operating sensor drones, but he knew Nert was only trying to help. The sensor drones provided to the Legion by the Ruhar were not state-of-the-art. They didn't need to be against the Wargalan. Most of the drone was a hydrogen-filled blimp that allowed the device to hover without any vertical thrust from its tiny propellers, so it barely disturbed the air around it. Packing a stealth field generator into a device the size of a sparrow would be almost impossible,
and such a field drew so much power, the power cells would last only minutes. Instead of artificial stealth, the drone relied on coatings that absorbed sensor pulses and chameleon wear that gave it the appearance of the background sky, cityscape, or whatever was around it. Still, Jesse knew the drone was living on borrowed time.
"Can you move it slowly?"
"Jesse," Shauna asked,
"what's up?"
"I'm seeing something in reflections off the windows of that office building with the blue tinted glass," he explained.
"Something's moving south of us."
Shauna had been scanning to the north and hadn't seen anything important.
"I'll check the—"
"Yeah, I see it," she agreed.
"I can't tell what it is.
A truck?" Jesse snorted.
"If that's a truck, the squids must have a monster truck rally planned for the weekend."
"Nerd," Shauna decided. "Move the drone."
"Okay," the cadet acknowledged. "I have to lift it first to reel in the cable, or it could get tangled."
Instead of using propellers to keep the drone in position, Nert had deployed a harpoon on a cable. It was not actually a harpoon. The end was sticky rather than sharp. He had it glued to the balcony of an apartment. When he got the harpoon attached and played out the cable so the drone hovered in the ideal position, he had been proud of himself. Now he worried that when he released the harpoon, the gusty wind would snag the cable around an obstruction before it could be reeled in. His fear was realized when the cable looped around an antenna projecting out from another balcony. The drone was jerked downward, and he severed the cable in the middle, instantly filled with doubt that he might have been too hasty. With the wind coming from the east, propellers were needed to reposition the device to the south, and propellers not only disturbed the air, they created sound waves. He took a risk by spilling hydrogen from the blimp, and the drone dove toward street level, where the wind swirled in the canyons between buildings. But the wind also wasn't blowing as hard. When he ordered the drone to rise again, a filter mechanism began extracting hydrogen from the air, reinflating the blimp.
"Drone will be coming around the corner in—"
"Oh my," he exclaimed.
"Holy sh—" was Jesse's reaction.
"Damn. Is that a tank?" The tank, if that is what it was moving across an intersection. The size of a typical city bus they had seen, its surface was smooth, without any windows or doors. The dark gray skin had black lines from nose to tail and side to side in the form of hexagons about half a meter across. Not even a single antenna blister marred the smooth surface of the vehicle, shaped like a teardrop when viewed from the top or sides, with the blunt end going first. Shauna zoomed in the drone image.
"How is it moving?"
Jesse studied the same image.
"I don't see any wheels or tracks."
"Nert, scan the street behind it. See if it made marks there."
"Just these."
Nert sent an image showing the entire roadway behind the tank was sunken in, crushed under the weight of the vehicle. The compressed surface was rippled side to side.
"Maybe it uses rollers?"
Jesse whistled.
"However it moves, it is damned heavy to crush the road like that. All right, we need to call this in. The platoon needs to know—"
"Ah!"
Nert cried.
"We just lost the drone."
Shauna smacked the floor with a hand.
"Damn it."
"Wait, wait," Jesse said softly.
"Maybe the drone is just being jammed. Nert, if that happens, if the drone loses contact, it is supposed to go into safe mode and return to us, right?"
"Correct,"
the cadet confirmed.
"I do not think the drone is being jammed. Just before we lost contact, there was a heat spike, like it was hit by a directed energy weapon."
"Yeah, well—"
Jesse wasn't giving up hope that easily. "We'll know for sure if we just wait a minute, so everyone chill." A minute went by, and there was no response from the drone.
"Nert, stop trying to ping it," Jesse ordered. "That could give away our position."
"What should we do now?" Shauna asked, flipping the cover back over the scope of her sniper rifle.
"We need to warn the platoon. That thing is headed in that direction, and it's not a taco truck."
Jesse's stomach growled, reminding him that he hadn't eaten since a hasty breakfast aboard the Big Mac. Two glazed donuts and coffee had been enough not to upset his stomach during the combat drop. Now he regretted not eating something more substantial. He sucked on a tube inside his helmet, taking in water and tasteless nutrients.
"If that thing was a taco truck, I'd tear it apart with my bare hands right now."
Shauna made a disgusted sigh.
Really? Hey, don't tell me you're not hungry too, Jesse defended himself. I can't think on an empty stomach.
There was food in his pack, but he would need to open his faceplate to eat. That could wait. Shauna was right.
Nert, before we moved the drone, it was showing the signal strength from the other drone with the platoon was only 18%. You agree?
Nert reviewed the data stored by his suit.
Yes. Even if we tried a full-power transmission from here, the platoon will not hear it without our drone to act as a relay.
And it would give away our position, Jesse added.
Shauna knew they were right. She also knew they could not fail to act.
We have to try something. The platoon needs to be warned there is a freaking tank headed toward them.
Jesse considered their options.
Maybe we can...
Hey, darling. He forgot they were in combat. What's the effective range of those sniper rounds?
That depends on a lot of factors, Shauna answered.
She hated being asked to give simple answers to vague questions.
If it's a straight line-of-sight shot where I can crank up the muzzle velocity, then the range...
This won't be line of sight. The round needs to curve around 180 degrees, he explained.
I just sent you a map of the city. See that tower under construction to the southeast of us? It's shaped kinda like a skinny egg.
Yeah. In the city center, a quarter of the high-rise buildings were under construction, so the skyline looked like a forest of scaffolding and cranes.
What about it? Can you make a shot from here that will curve so the round is coming from the east as it passes through the egg tower?
Whew, she whistled.
The round would have to go past the egg tower, make a U-turn in the air, and fly through the tower?
That is a tricky shot.
I think it's possible.
Jesse, what's the target?
That tank.
The tank? Are you crazy?
The armor-piercing rounds I have won't punch through that tank. It will just...
They don't need to. All we want is to piss off that tank crew, or whoever is driving it remotely. Make them think someone is shooting at them from the egg tower. If that tank shoots back, that will make a big boom, you know? Our platoon will be alerted there are bad guys around here.
Shauna thought for a moment, considering the complicated path the sniper round would have to travel.
It's worth a shot.
A shot. Literally, you know?
Yeah.
There's only one flaw in your plan, she noted. We can't see the target from here.
Sure we can, Jesse grinned.
Check this out.
He sent to her the image from his scope of a particular set of mirrored windows on a tall office building to the east. It showed the tank from the front and a good portion of the street behind it.
Wow.
She turned to look at the other staff sergeant.
That is good thinking.
It's good thinking if this works, he reminded her.
Leave that up to me.
She stood halfway up and walked slowly toward the south side of the floor, where there was a line of pallets stacked with construction materials. A gap between them would be excellent cover for her.
Now shut up and let me work.
Shauna waited until the tank had rolled out from under a pedestrian bridge that spanned the street, so she would have a clear shot. Using a 3D map of the city, she programmed a flight path for the explosive-tipped round, guiding it to fly through the open floor that was third from the top of the odd-looking egg-shaped office building. They assumed it was an office building, though none of them really knew or cared about the intended function of the structure. What mattered was that while the lower 11 floors of the tower were finished enough to have glass cladding all around, the upper 7 floors were still under construction, and the top 3 levels were almost completely unobstructed from one side to the other. Shauna did not have to worry about threading the round between pallets and crates and construction equipment as it passed through the structure east to west.
Gosh,
Nert whispered.
The tank is heavy. Look at the street behind it.
Shauna smiled. She knew from the tone of Nert's voice that he really had said gosh. The words had not been run through a translator. The Ruhar teenager's ability to speak English was getting better every day, and he was rapidly learning Mandarin Chinese. Shauna, meanwhile, could speak the common Ruhar language if she went slowly and thought carefully about it. Having a conversation with a native speaker of the alien language was difficult because the Ruhar tended to talk fast, and their slang varied between worlds. A Ruhar living on Gitanu would drop into their speech slang that was unique to that world. Mostly, Shauna still relied on her Z-phone's translator, and the old standby of smiling and nodding a lot when she didn't understand.
I see it, she acknowledged.
What Nert had noticed were holes in the street behind the tank. Its weight had crushed the road surface and pipes or tunnels underneath, leaving gaps where the road had collapsed. One section of the road had fallen in, leaving a trench 2 meters wide all the way across. Shauna wondered if that hole had exposed part of the city's underground railway system. Then she needed to push such thoughts to the back of her mind and focus on her job. Her thumb briefly pressing a button next to the trigger sent a brief, nearly invisible laser pulse at the target, or actually at the window they were using as a mirror. The laser beam bounced off the window and struck the front surface of the tank, causing no damage and scattering harmlessly. The scope of her rifle had tuned the spectrum of the laser to match the ambient light in the city, so the enemy would not realize they had been targeted unless their sensors knew what they were looking for or were very, very good. She held her breath. The tank didn't react, did not send back a targeting pulse of its own. If it did, the operators almost certainly would think the pulse had come from the window they were using as a mirror and not from a source behind them. The targeting laser beam was dispersed off the curved surface of the tank, with only a small percentage of photons bouncing back toward the window mirror, and only a tiny fraction of that light reached the scope of the sniper rifle. It was enough.
Range to target confirmed, Shauna said quietly.
The tank was grinding along at the same steady speed. She wanted to close her eyes to say a prayer, but that could wait for later. Her eyes were needed to keep the targeting crosshairs lined up on the image of the tank in the mirror window. One away. She pressed the trigger. The first round leapt out of the barrel at a medium velocity, moving upward more than forward. It coasted in a ballistic arc, aimed to the north of the strange egg-shaped tower, until it tipped over and began to fall. When it passed the tower, its stabilizing wings popped out, and the weapon swung around to fly backward, firing its motor first to cancel its velocity, then to move it forward. The round zipped through empty space between the upper floors of the uncompleted tower and accelerated at full power before it cleared the western edge of the floor, burning out its motor in a flash. The last bit of thrust was vectored to line it up with the oncoming enemy vehicle, and it was moving at a supersonic speed when it struck the smooth, curved front of the tank. The armor-piercing rifle round had no appreciable effect on the enemy vehicle. Its inert tip instantly became superheated plasma that could burn through most materials, but the tank's outer skin reacted with a powerful electric pulse that dispersed the plasma, splattering it outward harmlessly. The second, third, and fourth rounds all followed unique trajectories to fall behind the egg-shaped tower. Their flight paths programmed by Shauna to minimize the possibility that the enemy could trace the origin of the shots. All four of the rounds she fired came through the same upper floor of the tower and kicked in their motors at maximum acceleration, aimed straight at the tank that was still rolling forward. All of the rounds struck within a single square meter on the front slope of the tank, and none of the rounds had any useful effect on stopping the monstrous war machine. The tank's defensive sensors tracked the incoming rounds and determined the shots were coming from a tower to the east, specifically from the open floor 2 down from the top. Information was sent to the crew that was remotely controlling the vehicle, and a decision was quickly made.
Shit.
Jesse adjusted his scope to get a better view of the tank through the fine dust that formed a cloud in front of the enemy vehicle.
You hit it 4 out of 4. No effect.
Shauna checked the rifle's power cell. It was down to 43%.
I told you that these dinky little rounds wouldn't penetrate that type of armor. They're designed to...
3 loud, low, rolling booms echoed off buildings around them, shaking the floor they were laying on and shattering windows for several blocks. Dust rained down on them, kept away from the lenses of their scopes by magnetic fields.
Wow, Jesse exclaimed. Hell, I guess those rounds did have an effect. What is that tank shooting at? I don't see... Oh, shit.
He had been focused on the open floor of the egg-shaped tower, expecting the tank would direct its retaliation at the source of the sniper fire. Instead, the tank had struck the tower at a floor below the level Jesse could see from his vantage point. The top of the tower shook and tilted, collapsing to the south.
Oh my God,
Jesse watched, transfixed, as the upper floors, maybe the entire upper half of the tower, sagged. Held up only by the intact support structure on one side, the upper floors fell, the tower unable to hold up the dead weight. First, crunching down on one side, the upper part of the building pancaked downward, the jarring impact straining the lower structure with a load they were never designed to withstand.
"Oh, man," Jesse gasped. "I think the whole thing is... Hang on!"
He lost sight of the tower as the top fell below a building to the east, then couldn't see anything because a massive cloud of dust rolled outward like a fast-moving bank of fog, obscuring the area. Shauna snapped the cover back over her rifle scope.
"That's it. We are out of here."
Jesse was gaping at the sight in shock.
"They nuked the whole freaking building?"
"Maybe they just got lucky,"
Nert suggested.
"Unlucky,"
Jesse said as he stood up, no longer concerned about being seen by the enemy. In the thick dust that was choking the air, he could barely see the elevator shaft at the center of the floor.
"No way can that tank keep going east along that road. There's a building collapsed on it. They'll have to turn north or south and backtrack."
"If they go north, they could run into us," Shauna suggested.
"Shit. We should have thought this through before shooting. Let's get out of here pronto."
"Yeah," Jesse stood up. "One thing's for sure."
"What's that?"
Nert asked as he trotted toward the open elevator shaft.
"No way could our platoon have missed seeing that."
Chapter 29 Perkins skidded to a stop, literally skidding as her boots struggled for grip on the battle-scarred road surface. Automatically, her suit tilted the boot heels down to prevent her from toppling forward and deployed spikes for additional traction.
"What the hell is that?"
She pointed to the southwest as she came to a halt against a lamppost, cradling it with an elbow so she wouldn't topple over. Barely visible in a gap between several tall buildings and partly seen through the skeletal frame of a building that was surrounded by construction cranes, another tower that was only partially finished was swaying side to side. What had attracted her attention was the harsh bark of heavy artillery, or that is how her suit's computer identified the source of explosions. What she knew for certain was the sound was loud and shook the street so hard she had felt it through her boots. Before anyone could answer her, the top of the swaying tower slumped to one side.
"That can't be g-," she started to say.
Then the top of the tower dropped below sight. Moments later, the ground shook. Windows to the southwest blew inward, and a pall of smoke and dust rose from the site.
"Holy shit," someone exclaimed over the platoon channel.
"Did that just happen?"
"Platoon, halt and take cover," Perkins ordered. "I need comms," she said to Sergeant Lou. Lou looked around.
"It's going to be tough here."
She pointed to indicate the tall buildings that surrounded them.
"Make it happen," Perkins snapped. "Yes, ma'am. It would be best if I was in the plaza up ahead. There, go."
Lou sprinted ahead while Perkins allowed herself to be led into the dubious cover of a doorway. If the enemy was dropping heavy ordnance by artillery or air, the overhanging awning of a doorway was not going to protect her. She waited impatiently while she watched Lou, guarded by three soldiers, set up the bulky antenna that was the only way to communicate with the world beyond the city. Every drone they sent up had been destroyed or jammed with surprising and depressing speed. The cyber defense capabilities of the Wergalan were much more advanced than indicated by the intel provided by the Torgala. So far, the Torgala had been wrong about many aspects of the Squids in general and the status of their forces on Stiglord, so drones failing with regularity was not unexpected, just frustrating. Lou had the antenna deployed, its spiral-shaped bowl aiming at an unseen point in the sky. While Perkins silently urged the Chinese sergeant to work faster, she knew the process of aligning the antenna was a delicate matter, almost more of an art than science. After waving the antenna around, Lou shook her head, said something to the soldiers who had set up a perimeter around her, and carried the antenna to the northwest corner of the plaza, threading her way around abandoned and crashed vehicles. Wergalan urban planning seemed to like broad avenues and placing wide plazas where four or more roads came together. In the middle of the intersections were round or oval-shaped parks with statues or fountains. Lou set down the antenna and climbed on a bus, then reached down for a soldier to hand the antenna to her.
"Sergeant,"
Perkins called. You are awfully exposed up there.
Yes, ma'am,
Lou replied as she focused on getting the antenna aligned with the faint and garbled carrier signal.
This is the only way I can get line of sight from here, unless I go up on a roof somewhere, she suggested.
Negative. Perkins squashed that idea. Rooftops were even more exposed, and with power out all over the city, it would be a long climb up an interior stairwell to get to a roof.
Keep trying.
She knew they really had no alternative.
Be careful. You have our only tactical antenna.
The antenna is tougher than I am,
Lou grunted, wishing the Maverick's leader would shut the hell up and let her work.
If I'm hit, the...
Got it.
Exchanging handshakes now, and we have comms. Transferring to you now. The signal is only 2x5, she warned.
In her visor display, Perkins could see the poor quality of the signal. The other end was a starship more than a light second above the planet with a powerful transmitter to cut through the jamming. Even with the platoon's antenna boosting to maximum signal strength, she knew it would be difficult for the ship above to hear her clearly.
This is Colonel Perkins, she I-clicked to send her ID code. We are...
Colonel.
The voice of the Ruhar duty officer was distorted by jamming and interrupted by bursts of static.
Hold on, I am connecting you with General Ross.
There was a pause. Then Ross spoke, his voice sounding even worse.
Perkins, what's your status?
She knew Ross could determine her location from the data embedded in the signal. He could also see data from her suit computer about the physical status of all the soldiers with her, their ammunition supply, level of charge, and their power cells, and anything else he might want to know. When he asked for status, he wanted to know what she thought and was planning, not dry statistics.
We are proceeding out of the city along Route Echo, she reported. Enemy resistance has been sporadic since we broke contact.
Sir, someone nuked a building southwest of here. Please tell me that wasn't us.
She paused, waiting for Ross to get her message. Assuming the UNEF commander was still dirtside, the signal had to travel a light second or more up to the relay starship, then back down to Ross. Because of the jamming, her suit would repeat the message several times so the fragments could be reassembled properly on Ross's end of the line. The delays made for an awkward conversation.
We can't see what happened, but it was not us. Repeat, that was not our action. Perkins, there are 8 tanks converging on your position.
She waited for the little beep that indicated Ross had stopped speaking before she replied.
That got garbled. Did you say tanks?
She could not imagine what he might have said that sounded like tanks, but she could also not imagine him saying that word. Who the hell used tanks in modern warfare?
Tanks, yes. Some kind of large armored vehicles converging on your position. I'm sending the coordinates to you. Take a look.
The file got hung up in transmission, forcing her to wait. A map popped up in a window of her visor, and she enlarged it. The map was crude and lacked detail. It was good enough to see that if the information was true, she and her platoon were in serious danger.
What?
Ross resumed speaking, his voice increasingly distorted.
We're trying an airstrike to...
A roar of static drowned him out.
Out of there if...
Sir, she called. General Ross?
We lost the beam,
Lou warned.
Our antenna is being jammed directly. I can try...
No, Perkins ordered. Break down the antenna and get off that bus right now.
Switching to the command channel, she called out.
We're moving through the plaza and right, then left at the next intersection. Move now, she said with a fearful eye on the sky.
The enemy had locked onto their antenna and jammed it directly. That meant they had at least a rough idea of the platoon's location. As she passed through the plaza, running along in the middle of the column, she saw Sergeant Lou hop off the bus and adjust her backpack, then join the formation. When the last of the column cleared the plaza and turned onto the street behind her, she halted in the entrance to a substantial-looking building. The sign out front indicated it belonged to the municipal government. Though she had no idea what function the structure performed, she did know it had fewer and smaller windows than anything around, and that it appeared to be empty. That the facility had been hastily evacuated was evident from the broken front doors and the trash scattered around.
What's up, Colonel?
Dave asked, sticking to protocol.
Check this.
She sent the map to the suits of the platoon leadership, which included Dave. Ross has intel that the enemy is sending tanks against us.
Tanks?
Dave snorted a laugh, looking down at his sophisticated Ruhar skin suit. Sending tanks up against mech suits is a whole new kind of crazy. In his suit, he could easily outrun a tank, especially in an urban environment. The rockets fired by the launcher under his rifle barrel were designed to pierce the armor of an enemy mech suit, but he had used rockets against much stouter defenses. Several soldiers could network their rifles together and coordinate the impact of their rockets, collectively giving the weapons more punching power than an individual warhead. David Chaika was not afraid of any stinking tank.
"I hope you're right about that," Jates growled.
"Seriously?" Dave asked. "Would you want to be in a tank against a platoon in powered armor? It would be like that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know?"
Jates only cocked his head.
"Oh, yeah, right. You never saw that movie. There's a scene where the hero is confronted by a big, big dude with a sword, and the bad guy expects the hero to fight with his bullwhip, but he doesn't. The hero just takes out his pistol and," Dave pointed like he was holding a pistol, "bam, blows the bad guy away. Shit, any fight between a tank and a mech suit will be like that. I feel sorry for the guys inside, you know?"
"We don't know anyone is in the tank," Jate said. "It is most likely controlled remotely, or it is autonomously guided by an AI.
He looked at Perkins. Perkins shrugged. "We don't know anything other than that the fleet upstairs spotted at least 8 of them. With sensors being jammed, there might be more the fleet can't detect."
Jates nodded once, emphatically. "We do know one thing."
"What's that?" Dave asked.
"The enemy knows the capability of our infantry," Jates explained. "And they are sending tanks against us anyway. They are either confident or stupid."
"Shit," Dave groaned. "The squids haven't been stupid so far."
Colonel, he quickly caught his mistake. "We need eyes on one of those things. I can take a scout team to get intel."
Perkins shook her head. "Not yet. Ross told me he's planning an airstrike. He didn't say when, but my money is on it being soon."
"Shit. We are reacting to the enemy. We need to take the initiative."
"Look out the bright side," Jates observed with a growl, using one of the human expressions he had learned. "If we don't know what we're doing, the enemy can't anticipate our next move."
Dave shrugged. "The man's got a point."
"Oh, this ain't good," Jesse tapped Shauna's shoulder. "We got a whole school of squids down there."
"A school?"
Jesse, startled by the question, looked away from the scope to stare at her.
"Isn't that what you call a group of fish?"
"Sure, but the Wirgalin are land creatures."
Shauna shook her head without taking her own eyes from her rifle scope.
"How many?"
Jesse counted more than a dozen of the enemy, which would be a squad, but he wasn't going to say a squad of squids.
"I count. Wait, more of them coming into view. That's gotta be, wow, 30?
No." His scope was counting outlines.
40.
More enemy were coming into view, scuttling into the street with the odd and creepy motion of their multiple short legs.
"Damn, these guys are infantry. We're Wirgalin army, not local police. They must be here to move in behind that tank."
Shauna looked up, frustrated.
"How are you seeing this? My scope isn't showing—"
Nert agreed.
"I also do not see anything."
"Nert," Jesse explained. "That's because they are over on this side. You can't see them from there. Look at the feed from my scope. I'm doing the mirror trick again."
"Reflection off a window?" Shauna guessed.
Most windows in the area had shattered when the egg-shaped tower collapsed. That is why they had taken up position in what they guessed was an office building. They didn't need a balcony when every room was now open to the air. Shauna and Jesse were in the southeast corner, overlooking an intersection that was a broad plaza where 6 city streets came together. Without a drone to provide an overhead view, they were restricted to line of sight, and it was frustrating. It was also frustrating that they still had no contact with the platoon. To check whether the enemy was sneaking up behind them, Nert patrolled the other 3 corners of the building. The tank had rolled out of sight, but they had a good idea of its location from the grinding sound it made as it crushed the roadway under its great bulk.
"Not a window. See the truck that's stuck in the intersection?"
There were 3 intersections in view. All of them had vehicles jammed in traffic and abandoned.
"The truck has a logo kinda like a football or a watermelon."
"I see it."
"Okay,
Look at the outside mirror on the left.
Oh, she nodded.
Good eyes, hun, Jesse, she stammered, and inside her helmet her cheeks turned red at her mistake.
Yeah, you're right. That's a lot of squids.
Too much for...
Oh, hello.
What she had seen was a Wargalan soldier scurrying back to the main group, coming from the opposite direction. The soldier hurried to where three soldiers were huddled together, which was not anything special. What got Shauna's attention was what the soldier did with one of its tentacles, a twisting motion, raising and lowering the tentacle twice. It was saluting officers.
Sniper check, Shauna whispered.
Well, since they asked so nicely, Jesse whispered. Can you make a shot from...
Shauna's answer was to send a laser pulse to verify the range, then the rifle spat out two explosive-tipped rounds. The shot did not require any tricky planning or guidance, as the target was only two city blocks away, and at a 60-degree angle that was easy for the guided rounds to maneuver without excessive loss of speed. Not knowing which of the three Wargalan were officers being saluted, Shauna had chosen the two on the left, because her field of view was wider to the right. If the enemy ran to her right, she had an opportunity for a second shot. In the air, the two rounds coordinated their actions. The first unit delayed firing its motor until the second round had caught up and was flying on a parallel course. Because they had been given rather vague guidance before leaving the rifle, they switched on their active sensors and shared the data received, making final decisions as their motors kicked on. They went supersonic and were passing through Mach 7 at impact. The two Wargalan officers barely had time to notice warnings flashing in their helmets before the sniper rounds slammed into them and exploded. One round hit center mass and the torso of its target, the other misjudged the direction its target would move, so the strike hit the shoulder area. The difference in impact zone made no difference to the targets, both of whom were knocked backwards, holes burned through their powered suits, bones shattered, and soft tissue churned into jelly as fragments ricocheted around inside the armor. Both Wargalan dropped and were lost to view in the chaos. The formation of alien soldiers broke, individuals running for cover, though they didn't know what direction the deadly rounds had come from, and they knew the next round could follow an entirely different flight path. What had been an organized formation fell apart, with almost everyone who had a rifle spraying the area on full auto, while their leaders made futile appeals for calm. Two soldiers died when caught by friendly fire, their deaths adding to the rising sense of panic. Jesse kept his mouth shut and identified targets, tagging them by priority as Shauna kept up a steady fire. Each round that scanned the target area added to the rifle computer's knowledge of the situation, and it began making suggestions to Shauna. A round targeted at an enemy soldier taking cover under a truck noted that two enemy were huddled behind a car and passed that information back to the rifle. Though Shauna and Jesse could not see that pair of soldiers, the rifle knew where they were, and with Shauna's approval, guidance was adjusted to send two rounds high in the sky. Arcing up over where the pair of soldiers thought they had found effective cover, the rounds plunged down at a steep angle, gravity adding to the thrust of their motors. They struck the backs of the targets simultaneously, punching through the layer of armor over the power cells, then striking hammer blows on the inner layer of armor. That armor held with only fine cracks spiderwebbing outward from the impact sites, nanogel already flowing in to plug the breaches. Too late. The shattered power cells erupted, part of their released energy sizzling through the cracks and boiling the soldiers alive inside their suits. That was too much for the Wargalan force, which had been 50 strong when they entered the city behind the tank. Other than 9 experienced leaders, the soldiers were all trainees on the planet to learn infantry skills. Of the 9 leaders, 5 were new to their responsibilities and did not know what to do when the trainees panicked. Seeing a pair of soldiers struck in the back by enemy fire that apparently came out of the clear blue sky, the last nerves of the soldiers frayed, and without orders or against orders, they ran back along the route they used to enter the city. Efforts by their leaders to halt the panicked flight were ignored, so the leaders focused on trying to get some semblance of organization in the retreat, urging the formation to fall back by squads. 3 trainees hesitated, debating whether to provide cover for their fellows. Then a car's power cell exploded, and anything they had learned in training was forgotten in the need to get away as fast as possible.
Ceasefire! Ceasefire!
Jesse advised.
I've got 2 rounds ready, Shauna noted as she lifted her finger off the trigger button.
10 rounds had gone downrange, 8 of them finding their assigned targets, and all 10 causing fear and confusion in the streets.
They're running.
Jesse tried to keep the excitement out of his voice.
They're running! Damn, it's like you turned the lights on in the kitchen, all the cockroaches are running for cover. Hold fire.
Shauna was so hyped up, she wanted to find 2 more targets before she had to swap the magazine for a fresh one. She took a deep breath, knowing Jesse was right. They had accomplished their objective, preventing the Wergalan infantry from following the tank toward Perkins. She also knew that every round she fired increased the possibility that enemy sensors would track the projectiles back to their source. If that happened, the Wergalan could drop artillery on their heads. The tank destroying a building, even an incomplete structure, was probably unintentional, and she expected somebody on the enemy side would get a serious ass-chewing about that screw-up. But she also did not think the enemy would hesitate to use heavy weapons against a sniper, if that sniper was holding up the advance of an infantry unit.
Okay.
She lifted the rifle, automatically checking its power cell. The power cell and magazine should be changed before she used the weapon again.
Oh, yeah.
Jesse marveled as he watched the last Wergalan soldier flee out of view, leaping over a car in its haste to get away.
That was some damn fine shooting.
Shauna knew that a real trained sniper would have found plenty to criticize about her technique, target selection, even the choice of position. They were in the office building because it had been quick and easy to reach under cover of the thick dust cloud, which had begun to disperse from the wind by the time they reached their current location. Considering the minimal training she had been given, she was satisfied that the criticism she was giving herself was enough. She had made mistakes. She knew enough to recognize her errors, and she knew how to learn from mistakes.
Ah, she shrugged as she slapped a new power cell into the slot and verified it was active.
It was good enough.
Good enough? Did you see those squids running? You got half a company or more to turn their little legs around and run home to mama.
Yeah, unless they just turn at the next intersection and bypass us,
Shauna noted with a frown.
That mirror trick of yours only lets us see a few city blocks. We could,
hey, he patted her shoulder.
You did great.
I love you,
he added on impulse. He instantly realized what he'd said.
Sorry.
Shauna rolled onto one shoulder to look directly at him. Combat suit helmets could be awkward. Sometimes it was easier to turn your body rather than your neck.
Sorry?
Yeah, you know.
Sorry.
You're sorry that you said it, or?
Something in Jesse's brain told him he needed to put out that fire right then. Something else told him that was not the type of conversation to have while sealed up in a combat suit. He swung the faceplate open and spoke quietly, in case the enemy had acoustic sensors in the area.
I shouldn't have said it right then. Now, I mean.
Here, he sputtered.
I shouldn't have dumped it on you like that, you know?
She swung her faceplate up and wiped sweat out of her eyes.
Did you mean it?
She snapped.
Was not the right answer, Jesse Coulter. Look, this is, so freaking complicated. Life is complicated.
Yeah, but...
Look, guys can't say that. Can't be the first to say that. Ah, damn it. Being on Paradise has changed everything around, and we guys are still trying to figure out the new rules, you know? It's like, girls have all the power now. Women have all the power. A guy can't be the first one to say those 3 little words because you don't want to scare a girl. Woman! Don't want to scare a woman away.
Shauna's mood had turned to amusement, but she didn't let her partner see that.
Would you like to borrow a shovel so you can dig that hole you're in even deeper?
Shit. I don't know what to say. Women make the rules now. How about you tell me what I'm supposed to do? Hell, everything's easier for you.
Easy? How can you be so clueless?
Darling, he gave a heartfelt sigh. I'm really gonna need you to throw me a bone here because I got nothing, he admitted, Splaying his hands in a gesture to show he was not holding any cards.
Easy, huh?
Yeah, sure. You have your pick of men now. Any guy you want, you... Women don't want just any guy.
She rolled her eyes.
You're right about those three little words, though. That makes it worse for us girls, too.
It... He had no idea what she meant. Wisely, he zipped his lip and nodded for her to continue.
Listen, Jesse.
She patted his shoulder softly.
Sure, a woman wants to hear a guy say that. The problem is, especially on Paradise, a guy saying that doesn't mean he really feels that way. There are too many guys and not enough women. Guys are desperate, we know that. When a guy says I love you, it makes a woman wonder if he thinks she is Mrs. Right or just Mrs. Right here. We worry that guys latch on to the first woman who looks at him because he doesn't have a whole lot of options, you know?
Oh. Realization dawned on Jesse. Suddenly, a lot of things made sense.
You're worried that a guy is just settling for whoever he can get.
Yeah, sure. Wouldn't you think that?
You're worried that's what I think?
I don't know what you think because you don't say it. She let a bit of the exasperation she was feeling creep into her voice.
I just did. Then you said you were sorry for saying it.
You're not the only one who worries about... He bit his lip.
About what?
About someone settling. Wait. He held up a finger. Let me talk. I'm not real good at it, so read between the lines, okay? I worry that maybe we're together because we're in the same unit, you know? We sort of met way back on Camp Alpha and nothing happened. Well, not nothing. You were with Bishop, not with me.
That was a fling, she moaned.
Why do you guys always...
Let me finish, please.
The hamsters threw us together on Paradise because we knew Bishop back when they were investigating what happened to him. Then MB kept us together, and since then, well, we've been together because we served together. If it hadn't been for MB, who knows?
Seriously? You want to play what if with life?
I'm being honest, that's all.
You're asking, if it hadn't been for MB pulling us together to reactivate those Mazer cannons, maybe nothing would have happened between us?
Something like that, yeah.
Jesse, I don't know. Life doesn't come with a reset button. Maybe if MB hadn't contacted us, the Ruhar would have released us back to our units, and we wouldn't have ever seen each other again. If aliens hadn't invaded Earth, we probably never would have met.
Shit.
It doesn't matter. I don't care. We are together. That's what matters.
Am I special to you?
Oh, hell, you are special. Damn, girl, you kick ass.
You're special to everyone.
That was not the question she asked, so he added,
special to me?
Every time I look at you, I can't believe you're with me. You make me feel special.
Jesse Coulter. She placed her hands on both sides of his helmet and stared at him.
I love you. I'm sorry that I didn't tell you that before, if it made you worry so much. You,
Nert's voice squeaked.
Hey, guys?
Jesse gasped. He had completely forgotten they were speaking on the team channel. Nert had heard everything. He looked at Shauna. She looked at him. They both exploded with laughter.
Guys,
Nert pleaded.
Sorry, but I think we have a problem.
Chapter 30. The three-ship formation of Ruhar Vulture gunships were orbiting around an imaginary control point northwest of the city, their wings fully extended and engines on the lowest power setting they could manage while keeping the heavy spacecraft flying. There had originally been six Vultures, but one had been shot down by enemy fire, one damaged and forced to land for repairs, and the third ship had burned so much fuel during a dogfight it had to fly back to base for refueling. None of the gunships was supposed to be in the battle. The schedule had called for all to be back in orbit, with gunship duties handled by Legion aircraft. Unfortunately, the invasion schedule was no more than an amusing fantasy at that point. Spacecraft were not ideal platforms for air superiority or close support missions in an atmosphere,
but with few aircraft reaching the ground intact and fewer surviving the first hours of combat, the Vultures and their Ruhar pilots had been forced to remain on station far longer than anyone wanted. When the formation with the call sign of Silver Flight received the order to overfly the city, the pilots at first wondered what could be so damned important. The city was supposed to be a no-go zone, marked on Legion maps as an area to be avoided by air power and ground troops. Now, elements of three platoons were trying to fight their way out of the city, and plumes of smoke rose from where aircraft from both sides had met fiery deaths. Now they could see a tall plume of dust and smoke southwest of the city center, and they wondered what the hell the alien ground pounders had gotten themselves into this time. Reading their orders only made the situation more confusing. They were instructed to approach, but not overfly the city, get close enough to launch their standoff weapons, then return to orbit the control point. They were not to engage enemy aircraft unless they were fired upon, to avoid known anti-aircraft artillery sites, blah blah blah, the usual. Those parts of the orders were nothing new or unusual. Everything else about the orders caused the pilots to scratch their heads, which they couldn't actually do with their helmets sealed. Their targets were tanks, armored ground vehicles. From the intel provided by the Torgala, it was known that the Wargalan had such vehicles in their inventory, and information about tanks was included in the pre-mission briefing packet, but no one who read down that far into the data dump had taken the threat seriously. Not even when the Torgala warned that such armored ground vehicles had given them substantial trouble in past engagements. The general opinion of the Ruhar on that matter was, of course, the Torgala considered ground vehicles to be an obstacle, because the Torgala were not renowned as the greatest military force in the galaxy. The mighty Ruhar certainly did not have to worry about obsolete technology. The three spacecraft of Silver Flight turned and pointed their noses at the city, programming their missiles to home in on the coordinates provided by the starships above. When the Vultures were over the river that defined the northern edge of the city, they launched missiles by simply opening the bay doors, releasing clamps, and allowing the weapons to fall. Immediately after the last of the eight missiles cleared the stealth field of its spacecraft, the doors slid shut, and the Vultures began a gentle turn back toward the control point, keeping an eye on a pair of Wargalan fighter aircraft that were flying a parallel course to the south. The missiles fell on unpowered ballistic arcs, wings popping out to give them a controlled glide. When they were half a kilometer above the treetops, their air-breathing engines spun to life, and the missiles surged forward, keeping their speed subsonic. Wings swept backward, and the air ducts opened wide, gulping in more air than the engines required to dilute the heat signature of the exhaust. The missiles split up, each proceeding on a pre-programmed path to their target zone, but not to the targets themselves. The missiles would need to locate the tanks when they arrived. The missiles all flew at different speeds, so they would all reach their target zones at the same time. Striking targets simultaneously would not give the enemy time to be warned and react, and to learn from previous attacks. That was the plan. As the old saying goes, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Arriving over their target zones, only three of eight missiles located vehicles that matched the profile in their databases. Because of enemy broad-spectrum jamming, not all of the missiles were able to effectively communicate, and boosting transmitter power attracted attention. Two of the missiles that had located their targets went offline without warning, sending garbled reports as their transmissions cut off. Of the remaining six missiles, only four got the message that two of their companions had already been lost, and with communications unreliable, the six fell back to independent mode. The one missile which had a positive lock on its target folded its wings back and dove, kicking in its rocket motor when it detected an active sensor beam aimed in its direction. The missile raced forward through the speed of sound, going hypersonic as it disintegrated, fried by a plasma beam pulse from the target. Charred parts of the missile casing pinged harmlessly off the tank that continued to grind ahead. Feeding power to their active sensors, the surviving five standoff weapons climbed to scan a wider area of the city. Lighting off active sensors was equivalent to shining a strobe light, and the missiles knew they did not have long to live. Mission success or failure was a simple matter of mathematics. Could they locate and attack a target before enemy defenses knocked them out of the sky? The answer, no.
Two missiles never identified anything on the ground that looked like a tank before they were fried by plasma beams. One missile found a tank rolling along a street two blocks west of the target zone, but during the seconds it took to turn around and line up in attack, it was struck by a fragmentation warhead from a Wargalan anti-aircraft missile launched from the ground. That left two missiles that had both positively identified targets and remained active long enough to strike their respective tanks. A plasma beam seared through the air just after one missile turned, missing by half a meter. That missile cleverly curved around a building to attack its slow-moving target from the front, leaving the tank's sensors momentarily confused. The hard turn bled off airspeed, so the missile was traveling at subsonic speed when it came around the corner and rammed the target at an angle, much of the explosive force of its warhead deflected upward by the glancing nature of the impact and the slope of the tank's front surface. The shaped charge warhead directed its energy sideways as much as possible. Still, only a quarter of the energy was focused on the tank's forward armor. The warhead had little effect on the massive vehicle. Part of the outer layer of armor was burnt and flaked away. Most of the hexagons of plating in the affected area were left in place. Those too badly damaged were pushed outward to fall away, with a fresh new layer rising into position. Within seconds, the only sign the tank had been struck was a star-shaped pattern of soot splattered across its smooth front. The second tank was hit by an attack from the top, with the incoming missile arcing over the roof of a parking structure to keep itself out of view as long as possible. It was deflected slightly by a plasma bolt at the last second, so the warhead struck the sloping left side rather than square on the top. That warhead got lucky, impacting at a relatively thin part of the armor plating, but the tank protected itself by detonating reactive armor, sending an explosion outward as the missile's warhead exploded forward. The force of the warhead was dissipated into a broad cone rather than a focused lance of spear-heated plasma. The second missile also had little effect. All eight tanks kept rolling toward the group of Verdkris and humans. The missiles did have one effect. They attracted the attention of the invaders who were trying to fight their way out of the city. "Lou," Perkins gestured to the sergeant as she tried to count the new, thin trails of smoke all around her. "On it, ma'am," Lou acknowledged, sprinting up the street with the folded tactical antenna on her back. She had not followed approved procedure by stowing the antenna in its holding case. The antenna was exposed to damage without its case, a trade-off for being able to deploy it quickly. Lou now had a good idea of where the relay ship was located in space, so she did not need to search a broad cone of the sky to find the guide wave. Gaining speed as she ran, she slammed a foot down on the pavement to send her vaulting up on top of a truck that was partly on the sidewalk. Perkins would not like her being so exposed, and Lou wasn't thrilled about it either. Checking that her rifle was securely attached to its sling and side holster, she crouched and bolted upward, folding her forearms in front of the helmet faceplate as she crashed through a window and smashed knees first onto a heavy desk. The desk cracked under her weight and sent her rolling to the right onto the floor. "I'm okay," she called on the platoon channel, rising to punch the remaining shards of glass from the window and drag the broken desk out of the way so two other soldiers could follow her.
"You're crazy. You know that, right?" one of the soldiers wagged a finger at her.
"Ah, come on," Lou grinned. "You had fun too." "Sergeant," Perkins called. "Was that really necessary?" Lou pulled out the antenna and unfolded it before answering, pointing it at a particular section of the sky. With the relay ship more than a light second away, it wasn't going to shift its position in the sky much over a few minutes. She only had to account for the planet she was on rotating at roughly 300 meters per second at the city's latitude, so...
"Got it," she announced triumphantly. "We have a link, Colonel."
Other than receiving a tone to indicate the platoon-level communication system had established a proper encryption handshake with the relay ship, Perkins got no response to her calls. Sending a short message via text also was futile, until the message was sent a third time. The response was short. "Airstrike no effect. Need accurate guidance on one target. Advise when ready."
"What the?"
Perkins read the message a second time.
"Colonel?"
Dave asked, leaning forward. He could tell Em was reading a text message, yet she hadn't shared it.
They need us to paint a target for them, she said while composing a reply.
Paint?
Jates shook his head, unsure he had heard the translation correctly. Dave explained. We need to tell the missiles exactly where one of the tanks are. Like, paint a bullseye on it, you know?
Oh.
Jates did not understand how the eye of a bull, an earth animal, was related to the task, and he knew better than to ask.
Colonel, I can do that.
We can do that, Dave corrected the bird. I want to see one of these tanks anyway.
Chaika?
Perkins wore a pained expression. She did not like the idea that any of her people would get close to an enemy armored vehicle that had survived an airstrike. She especially did not like Dave volunteering for a dangerous task.
This isn't a game.
We'll be careful, he assured her. The only problem will be maintaining a link back to the antenna. He jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the window where Lou had the antenna pointed to the sky. We'll need relays.
Colonel, Lou spoke, we can't keep the link open long, or the enemy will pinpoint our location.
Cut the link, Perkins decided. Chaika, contact us as soon as you have the target designated.
That looks like a slug, Dave whispered when he first saw the tank.
He was severely disappointed by his first view of the alien armored vehicle.
Or a really ugly caterpillar.
Did you know, Specialist Cotri asked, that tanks are called tanks because in the First World War, the project to develop armored vehicles was funded under the cover story that it was about water tanks.
Jates ignored the comments of Dave and Cotri.
Cut the chatter. Do you have coordinates?
Yeah, sure.
Dave had the rangefinder of his rifle scope locked on the smooth top surface of the tank. He was using passive sensors, basically the sunlight reflecting off the dull skin of the tank. The rifle's internal computer knew where he was, and the spectrum of ambient light around him, so based on how the sunlight changed when it reflected off the tank, the rangefinder knew the enemy vehicle's location within millimeters. Or some shit like that. Dave didn't understand the details. All he knew was that his rifle scope stated the tank was 232.6 meters from his location, which was too close. He did not know what type of ordnance the Legion planned to drop on the tank, but it had to be stronger than whatever warhead had failed to scratch the damn thing the first time. Over 200 meters seemed like plenty of distance for safety, especially for troops protected by armored suits. That did not account for two factors. The tank was moving, getting closer every second, and the team providing eyes on the target had no idea when the airstrike was coming. Also, they were in an urban environment. Direct shock waves and shrapnel from explosions were not the only hazards. In the confines of the crowded city, an explosion could trigger a building to collapse on top of the ground team, crushing even their suits under thousands of tons of debris. Dave's curiosity about the tank had been thoroughly satisfied, and he was beginning to think that Jates could be right. The Wargalan knew the capabilities of skin suits, yet they had sent the tank anyway. The enemy was confident that the tank, which seemed like a laughably slow and clumsy ancient weapon, would be effective against the invading army. Dave didn't want to be around to find out if the enemy was right.
Jates, he said without taking his eyes off the scope. We have enough data.
The tank was grinding its way straight down a broad avenue that ran southwest and northeast across the city, aiming for a point where it would intercept the Legion troops. Its motion was steady at around 15 kilometers per hour. Dave had wondered why the vehicle was traveling so slowly along a flat, straight avenue with few obstructions. Then he got a good view of the road surface behind it. The massive tank was crushing the pavement and busting through pipes, power conduits, and tunnels that ran under the surface. Going any faster might risk the tank digging a hole that would slow it down even more.
We're ready for relay.
Send the signal, Jates ordered Cotri, who was positioned another 150 meters behind them with the relay.
Dave saw an icon light up in his visor, and he pressed a button on the side of his rifle, authorizing it to share the targeting data. The signal was one way. He had no way to know if the coordinates were being received by whatever aircraft needed the data, nor did he have a way to know when the airstrike would be arriving. He checked the steadily decreasing range to target.
We need to think about pulling back, he suggested.
They had set up on the second deck of a parking garage where an empty vehicle had become good cover,
after Dave smashed out the windows with the butt of his rifle. The structure was made of whatever concrete-like substance the Wergalan used pretty much all over the city, and because the parking garage had to hold the weight of cars and trucks, it was solid, constructed more strongly than any residential or office building. It had seemed like an ideal location from which to get eyes on the target, and it was. Dave was realizing as he watched the enhanced view of the rifle scope as the armored slug crawled steadily toward him, that a parking garage was not ideal for a quick escape when they would need to relocate. The ceiling was low, leaving little space to squeeze between the tops of vehicles and the deck above. That wouldn't be a problem because the garage was mostly empty, except that the second floor was jammed. Cars and trucks from the three decks above had tried to drive down through the second deck where traffic was jammed because of accidents on the first floor and because the clogged streets outside made it difficult for any vehicles to get out of the garage. The result was a crowded mass of abandoned cars and trucks, forcing the Legion team to squeeze through to get a view of the tank. "That's it," Dave muttered to himself as he kept the crosshairs lined up on the sloping front of the tank. "This would be a great time to drop a missile on that thing. Come on, guys." When they received the target coordinates, the three Vulture gunships of Silver Flight again broke from the lazy circle they had been flying around the control point west of the city and went to full power, streaking toward the target. With the enemy alerted to the threat of air-to-ground missiles, they had to reduce the flight time of the weapons and attempt to draw away defenders. Before Silverflight reached the imaginary line in the sky where they would launch their remaining weapons, five enemy fighters to the south turned to engage and fired off a half-dozen air-to-air missiles. The Vulture pilots held their course, anxiously watching the incoming missiles while the seconds counted down. 3, 2, 1. Each of the Vultures ejected a single missile and immediately turned hard and climbed to put distance between themselves and the enemy weapons that had gone hypersonic. To the northwest, two smaller missiles rose from the city seeking the same targets. The Vultures activated their defensive maser turrets as two more missiles rose from the city. The three missiles launched by the Vultures did not need to seek targets. They knew exactly where the tank was and had an accurate map of the city for six blocks around the armored vehicle. They split up, flying three different approaches toward the tank, and coordinated their actions so they came around or over buildings within milliseconds of each other, kicking on their booster motors for the terminal drive. "One more minute," Jates ordered, pressing a reassuring hand on Dave's shoulder. The tank itself was clearing the traffic jam from the streets by plowing vehicles aside. The blunt, sloping nose of the tank shoved cars left and right, and in some cases, up and over, to tumble on top of other wrecked vehicles. The tank squeezed to the right to go around a stalled tanker truck, going up onto the sidewalk where it knocked cars into buildings, breaking away the front of street-level shops and smashing down trees that lined the sidewalks. The path of destruction was extensive even before the tanker truck was tipped over and split open, spilling out whatever greenish liquid was inside. Dave feared a spark would set the whole street afire, but although the liquid smoked and burned everything it touched, it didn't appear to be flammable. Yellowish foam bubbled up from the street and enveloped the tank, until some kind of pulse flung it away. Droplets splashed everywhere, and the surfaces touched smoked and sizzled. "Shit," Dave groaned. "Look, that acid stuff didn't touch the tank at all." There was not even any discoloration on the tank's skin. "It is time." Jake stood in a half-crouch. "I'm activating the relay." He pressed a button on a walnut-sized device stuck to a column where it overlooked the street in both directions. The relay didn't glow or beep when it went online. It just turned a light gray to match the color of the column it adhered to, and Dave saw another icon light up on his visor. "Khatri," he called to the soldier positioned back up the street near where the avenue took a broad curve to the north. "You got this?"
"Affirmative," Khatri answered, and sent a view from the scope of his rifle looking through the relay. "Signal is 3x5.
"Good enough," Jates grunted. "Chaika, we're moving." Dave squeezed himself out of the van where he'd been kneeling, bumping his head on the top of the door opening. "Right behind you," he said as he slung his rifle. He and Jates planned to leapfrog past Khatri's position and allow that soldier to pull back.
They needed to keep doing that until the second airstrike struck the tank, and Dave sure as hell hoped that was soon, because Perkins and elements from three platoons were stalled until they had a way past the encircling armored vehicles.
That was disappointing.
Jates glanced back over his shoulder to get one last look at the tank before squeezing around and climbing over alien cars.
You hoped that acid from the tanker truck would eat the tank? Dave guessed.
No. Jates snorted. I wanted to see the tank crush that truck or something.
Oh, Dave laughed. Yeah, if this was a monster truck show, I'd want my money back. Any bulldozer can push cars aside, but...
A message flashed in his visor. Missile warning, 14 seconds.
Shit.
Dave looked around.
Stairwell? Follow me.
Jates didn't waste any time looking for better options, because there weren't many. The parking garage was strongly constructed, but the interior was exposed. They had no idea what ordnance the airstrike would deliver, other than that it had to be more powerful than the missiles used the first time. He did not want to be caught under four decks of the garage if it collapsed. Running to the side of the garage, then rolling over the edge, he dropped out over the hard sidewalk below.
Oof!
Dave grunted as his boots smacked into the sidewalk, cracking the concrete-like surface. Rolling to the right to protect the rifle that was slung on his left side, his helmet bounced off a lamppost, then the tree next to it. Pushing himself upright with his legs already moving, he scrambled to run after Jates. The Verd had superior strength and speed, even with both of them augmented by powered skin suits, so Dave knew the Surgeon's leg was still hurting badly when he wasn't running any faster than Dave could manage. Vaulting over a car, Dave gained ground, coming down on the opposite sidewalk.
Hey, where are we?
Without warning, he was blown off his feet. Chunks of concrete, shards of glass, and probably parts of vehicles blasted out of the parking garage rained down on Dave as he rolled to a stop against a post in front of what looked like a hotel. Ash and soot and dust obscured the view, even with the enhanced synthetic vision provided by his helmet sensors. But being blind did not stop him from unwrapping himself from the post, crawling, then pushing up to stagger down the sidewalk. The suit computer understood his need to get away from the blast zone, so it overlaid the hazy real view with a snapshot from its memory of the scene just before the explosion.
Jates!
Dave waited a moment, knowing the low-powered laser link between helmets was having trouble with all the dust in the air.
I'm here, came the reply.
Dave stopped, looking for the source of the signal.
Where is here?
The gusty wind was already blowing dust away from the street back toward the source of the explosion. A large piece of metal that had fallen from the facade of the hotel moved, heaving upward, and Jates's legs stuck out from under the heavy debris.
Here.
Gotcha.
Dave held up a corner of the twisted metal so Jates could wriggle out, letting the piece of facade clatter down on the sidewalk when the Surgeon was clear of it.
That was close.
Jates had no time to reflect on his good fortune.
Did we get it?
The tank?
Dave hadn't pinged the relay, being busy with more immediate concerns.
I don't know.
The relay is down, he noted without surprise. Cars were hanging out of the parking structure, where the side walls were crumbled. It didn't appear that the garage was in danger of collapsing, though he didn't want to test that notion.
We can contact Cotry when we're line of sight to the next relay.
He waved to Jates, jogging along the debris-strewn sidewalk.
You okay to move?
I can outrun you even without a powered suit.
I can't see anything.
Perkins ran the sensor feed back to the point of impact when the view became totally obscured. The relay closest to the tank had stopped transmitting, so she had no idea of the tank's fate. All she knew was that at least one missile had been intercepted by a plasma beam while it was still 20 meters from the tank. The premature detonation of that warhead had knocked out the relay before that device provided a view of whether the other two missiles had scored hits. Loss of one missile to defensive fire was bad news. Its explosion might have knocked the other two off course.
Can Cotry see anything?
Not yet, Colonel, Lou answered. He's too far away. There's a lot of dust obscuring the target area.
Dave and Jates should have run along a side street parallel to the main avenue until they were past Cotry's position. Instead, they only went one block, then turned left to creep around a corner,
because neither of them could wait to learn whether the tank had survived. Given the size of the explosion, Dave expected the tank would be a smoking wreck.
"Hell yeah," he breathed when he poked the scope of his rifle around the corner.
The avenue toward the tank was a scene of devastation, building fronts collapsed or pockmarked by shrapnel. The tank stood alone in the center of the scorched area, all the civilian vehicles having been blown away from it in a wide circle. The view of the tank was through a gap in a jumble of cars and trucks, and the view was encouraging. The sloping front of the armored vehicle was battered and dented in, like a giant had struck it with a hammer. The explosion had busted a water line, sending a geyser up to shower the street. Water cascaded off the tank, which was no longer grinding its way along the avenue.
"We got it," Dave whispered, mentally pumping a fist while he kept both hands on the rifle. "Let's get—" "Ah, shit!"
The front of the tank rippled, the skin reforming as hexagon-shaped panels repositioned and new panels came from the interior. As Dave watched, the dent filled in, loss of material forcing the sloping front to be more narrow than before.
"Motherf—"
he ground his teeth as the tank lurched forward again.
"Damn it!"
Pulling back around the corner, he pointed his rifle up the street, aiming for the relay near Cotri's position.
"Maverick lead," he called. "This is Echo 6. No joy. Repeat, no joy here. Those missiles were Whiskey Delta."
He used a polite phrase for weak dick.
"All they did was scuff the paint. We need something stronger."
There was a pause, and he could hear Emily take in a breath.
"Understood.
Pull back to our position, 6.
"Wait," Dave said, forgetting they were on an open channel.
"Can we try again with something bigger?"
"No.
Those Vultures are Winchester on missiles, and we have no other air assets available." Before Dave could reply, Jates tapped him on the shoulder and spoke.
"Acknowledged, Maverick lead. We are pulling back."
Dave turned around angrily and snapped over the helmet-to-helmet link.
"We need to stop that damn tank, or the whole platoon is—"
"I didn't say we were pulling back right now," Jates said softly, and Dave was startled to see the Verd wink at him.
Okay. What are we doing?"
Jates aimed his rifle scope at a sign across the street, a sign that was pockmarked and swaying in the wind, held on by only one corner.
"You humans are so dumb. Can you read that sign?"
"Hell no," Dave snorted. "It's written in squid and—"
"Duh. Sorry."
He eye-clicked to focus on the sign and a translation popped up.
"Holy shit. There's a subway running under the streets here?"
"Exactly."
"You thinking what I'm thinking?"
"I don't know."
Jates shook his head and turned to run back down the street.
"I'm having trouble with the concept that you are capable of thinking."
Perkins sent a burst message to Ross. "Airstrike ineffective. Enemy closing on our position." She did not need to add "situation desperate." The general could read between the lines. The platoon's scouts had made contact with what they originally estimated was a squad of Wargalan soldiers, and she had been tempted to push through. Then the scouts reported they were engaged with at least 20 of the enemy, and she ordered them to pull back. Her platoon was surrounded, with the enemy closing in from all sides. It might be possible for small groups to evade the tightening enemy cordon and escape from the city, but that would mean leaving the injured behind, an option she did not want to consider. Would not consider. Ross read the message and considered his options. The Vultures were out of missiles, and after the second airstrike, one of them had been shot down by missiles and enemy aircraft had destroyed another. Additional air support was out of the question, even if he had assets in the area. The missiles carried by Vultures were intended for air-to-air or anti-personnel missions for use against ground troops in light armor. Those missile warheads simply did not have enough punch to penetrate the thick armor of a tank, for which he did not blame the Ruhar. How could they have known the enemy would use tanks? The situation in Slugtown was a god-awful mess, and it was partly his fault. His intention had been simple. Send an experienced officer to take charge of the chaos in the city and extract the Legion force that was trapped there, before the Wargalan brought in reinforcements and the incident spiraled out of control into a major battle.
Now he realized that he had done nothing but escalate the situation. If the Wargalin captured or killed the survivors of two mostly Verdcris platoons, that would be a tragedy for those Legion soldiers. But if the Squids captured the Mavericks, it would be a disaster in political terms. While UNEF headquarters was irritated by the cowboy attitude of Emily Perkins, they also knew how widely popular she and the Mavericks were, with UNEF troops and with the Ruhar public. The thought of the Wargalin parading them as prisoners made him queasy. Surely the Squids knew who was in their city. Legion communication security was good, but not unbreakable. All he had done was dangle a big fat target in front of the enemy, and now the Mavericks were in as much trouble as the people they were supposed to rescue. He had to get them out, regardless of the consequences. Close air support was not possible, and he could not risk employing artillery in the city, even if he had long-range artillery in the area, which he didn't. That left only one workable option. Decision made, he sent a brief message to Admiral Cacrondo, then called General Bezenson. Lin, you're up.
Sir?
There was a delay in the reply because the Achakai fleet was half a light second away. I assume you've been following the events in Slugtown. We have elements of three platoons there, and the enemy has armored vehicles closing in. They need close base support to clear an egress corridor toward the west. The reply was delayed longer than required by speed of light limitations. Slugtown is a no-go zone. The Ruhar will approve of an orbital strike? The Achakai fleet is under Kakrondo's command. He doesn't need permission from Kuhn. Close space action will be under your direction. Understood. Rules of engagement? Minimize collateral damage. The city is mostly evacuated, but there could still be civilians in the area. Perkins will need a 3-block no-fire area around her position. I'm sending the coordinates to you now.
The enemy is using tanks?
Don't underestimate them. We hit one of those tanks twice with air power, and it's still moving.
Do the tanks have infantry support?
Affirmative. Take out the tanks and targets of opportunity. Use your judgment.
Shit. Jeff, I can't do this from here.
That's why it's called close space support.
Got it. I see the coordinates of Perkins's team. How the hell did she get into such a damned... Forget it. We're calculating the jump now. Time over target zone is 3 minutes. We've been matching course and speed with that section of the planet, so we won't need long to maneuver into position.
Lin, I need you to plow a road out of the city for Perkins. Whatever you gotta do, do it. Ross out. Bezenson cut the circuit and waved over the person who would actually be conducting the strikes. Major Shen pushed away from his console and floated over to her station. His face was puffy from the zero gravity, and once again, Lin missed the artificial gravity aboard Ruhar ships.
Major,